Welcome to the Gospel Rain podcast, part of the teaching ministry of Dr. Matt Brown and Dr. Micah Carter. We hope you will find gospel-centered answers to your questions about theology and the Christian life. And now, we welcome you to the Gospel Rain conversation.
Welcome back to the Gospel Rain podcast. I'm here with Matt. It's good to see you again, my friend, my brother.
Yes, good to be with you.
And we are broadcasting on this episode from our college alma mater, Blue Mountain College, here in North Mississippi. And it's a great joy always to be back on campus, but we're here today for a ministerial alumni gathering, a day that's set aside every year for men who came to study for the ministry, come back and see one another and worship together and eat and fellowship. So it's been a good day all the way around. And so we wanted to take some time to do an episode with a dear brother to me, and I know you're meeting Mike for the first time, but he's here as a guest musician, I guess, to lead worship and to love on us through the talents the Lord has given him. And I want to introduce you, Gospel Rain listenership, to Mike Harland. Mike is the director of Lifeway Worship. For Lifeway. He's a Mississippian, and we're glad to have you on the show, Mike.
I'm tickled to be here. All my family still live in Corinth. Most of my family went to Blue Mountain College. I'm about the only one that didn't. And so they let me back on the campus now. But but any time to come to North Mississippi and be with Mama and my dad and my brother and my sister, I see all my whole crew, it's a privilege to be here.
Well, cool. It was great to see your face. Mike and I worked for a number of years at Lifeway corporate headquarters in Nashville. Mike is still at Lifeway. I have since moved on to pastor church here in North Mississippi, and it's just like a homecoming.
You know, Micah, we did have a special friendship while you worked there, and we would run across each other from now and again, and we'd talk about Ole Miss football.
That's right.
You were my Ole Miss
I heard about that.
Sounding
good. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I heard
exactly.
About Ole Miss football.
Yeah, exactly. And it was always good to see a Mississippian up there in Nashville with me. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I bet it was. I'm the odd man out. I'm not the Ole Miss fan around the table today.
But you're loved, brother.
But I am loved. Thanks. I feel the love.
That's right. And, you know, we've done, so Mike was asking us a little bit about our podcast, and we've been cranking about a year. We've done a couple of episodes around worship and discussions. We had our music ministers on with us for one episode. That was a lot
of
fun.
Yeah, I'll have to listen to that one.
Worship.
Good.
And, Mike, you know, we wanted to really pick your brain on a couple of things for a few minutes.
Cool.
If we had a chance to, can I just jump out and go
ahead?
Yeah,
go ahead.
So one thing Matt and I were talking about just recently on a trip, we were coming home in the car, we were talking about this. We were talking about the decline of hymnody in the church, the singing of hymns specifically. Now, let me set up this is the freshest example of this, so it tees you up perfectly. We just sang in chapel, The Solid Rock.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if it was a technical glitch or whatever, but the words were not up on the PowerPoint.
They weren't.
So I panned the audience of college students, and guess what?
They know it.
Some of them did.
Some of them did.
But most of them did.
Well, especially when we got to the second verse.
Second verse. Yeah, they knew the first verse.
First verse, most people
know.
They
were good on the refrain.
That's in the refrain.
You're right.
Yeah. But the verses, and you know, one of the things we were lamenting was it seems like we've lost, in some ways in the church, a common you know, palette of music where anybody can sing. And we know what we're singing.
Yeah.
And talk to us a little bit about hymnody and kind of where we are as a church, church music.
It's very interesting to study this and to see the history of the church in it. You know, back in the day, well, go all the way back to the Old Testament, and there was a specified collection of psalms and hymns and prayers that would be sung and carried through generation to generation. And then, of course, in the era of printing and when the hymnals began to be created. The very first one Lifeway made was in 1904. Mm-hmm. It's Baptist Sunday School Board made it. Now, here's a little insider information. The Baptist Sunday School Board did not have a church music department in 1904, but they released a hymnal. The hymnal was made through the offices of the Methodist Publishing House.
Yeah.
So if you ever wonder why we Baptists sing so many Wesleyan hymns, the Methodists made our first hymnal.
They made the cut.
Made the 1904 hymnal, the first one the Baptist Sunday School Board released. The first one the Baptist Sunday School Board made was 1940 with B.B. McKinney.
Right.
And then we made one in 56, made one in 75, made one in 91. And then the most recent one that I was part of was the 2008, which is now 10 years old. Mm-hmm. But before the advent of projection And before the advent of contemporary Christian music that began to, that really grew out of the Jesus movement. I mean, I'm going all over the map here. Right. But there was a defined number of hymns, and Baptist churches all tend to sing the very same songs and hymns from those hymnals, like the 1956 or the 1975, et cetera. So, but with the coming of worship songs that were growing out of the Jesus movement, then contemporary Christian music, and then we began to project lyrics, and then other instruments began to find their way into the worship experience. The hymnal, we were no longer just limited to what the hymnal could do. We were now bringing in everything, and with that, songs for that era have gotten simpler, more repetitive, and the repertoire of churches has drastically changed. I mean, the church that I grew up in would have sung probably at the very most 150 different titles a year, morning and night. We had more Sunday evening services, and we would only sing that. And then a very specified number of those would be just at Christmas or just at Easter. They were associated with those. Now there are churches that will sing hundreds and hundreds of different titles over the course of a year. Right. So the repetition of songs is not nearly as great. So it's not just a matter of the hymns themselves being easier to remember. It's that the church sings so many more songs.
Good point.
And songs have gotten to be so much simpler that they don't usually stick around very long.
Yeah.
And so the term I came up with, it's my term. I don't know if it says anything to anybody but me, but I call it song velocity.
Okay.
The song velocity of a church is probably five times now what it would have been when you and I were growing up.
You know, that's a huge insight. You know, I'm a fan of much of contemporary music. Obviously, I was raised on the hymns, love the hymns, deeply embedded in my spiritual life and journey, no doubt. I lament a little bit that with that velocity that my sons aren't as familiar with some of the foundational songs that I sang as a child and that they're in my heart, that kind of thing. But that's a great term, you know, and there's a lot of good music being produced. Not all the new music is good music necessarily.
And
but
not all the old music is good.
That's exactly right.
That's a good distinction to make, too.
Is there anybody, okay, so if our listeners are familiar with the Gettys, for example, they write kind of new hymnody.
Modern hymnody, sure.
So are there others writing in this style, maybe this kind of channel?
So I have good news. We have come through an era where the song of faith has gotten so experiential. It's not that the modern worship songs of the last 15 years were just simpler than hymns or dumbed down, if you will. They were also not very theological. They were much more focused on emoting my experience, saying less about God himself and more about how I feel about God.
Right.
And that's the part where the church really began to realize we're losing something here. I think every generation has their own hymns and are going to have their own songs. This is a point I make about this sometime. You know, the Psalms, there are a number of Psalms that have tune names associated with them. You can look at the superscriptions and you can see to the tune of.
Right.
There were tunes of that era, and some of them were actually married to texts. Even in the dating, when Ezra was assembling the Psalter, there were associations with particular tunes. And I've pondered the question for years. If God preserved the text, and we certainly know that he did, we believe with all confidence that what we are seeing in the Psalms today is exactly what they saw then, with the translations that are involved, why didn't he preserve the tunes? And he certainly could have. And if there was a book in the Bible called Tunes. You know, we've got one called Numbers. There could have been one called Tunes. Then we wouldn't even be having this discussion. We would be singing just that. I believe God welcomes us into the creative process by allowing every generation to find our own expression musically. But what began to happen in the worship era is it became so emotive which the Psalms are emotive. You know, it's not right. that there's no room for emotional expression, but that's all they ever were. And they were, we were not having that rich, think about what we sang this morning, my hope is built on nothing less than Jesus' blood and righteousness. I dare not trust the sweetest frame, but holy. I mean, there's all kinds of theology
poetic.
In
oh,
that.
Yeah. Mm.
But a lot of the modern worship songs don't necessarily express that kind of theology. So, but here's the great news. The church has awakened to mm-hmm. this issue, and pastors and church leaders are no longer satisfied with a quality music expression, but now would like to use the music tool as a discipleship tool, mm-hmm. the way I believe God intended us right. to use it. I love to talk about music as discipleship. It's an amazing thing to think about. And we've moved into an era now with the advent of people like Keith and Kristen, mm-hmm. Stuart Townend, right. but there are others, Matt Redman, Tim Hughes.
Matt Boswell
would yeah. be a wonderful mm-hmm. example and a great friend. I'm glad you mentioned him. There are people writing modern hymnody, and interestingly, I'm sorry, I'm chasing many rabbits here. I'm giving you the whole weekend seminar right now in this
That's
one
good,
podcast.
That's great.
There are really no technical music attributes of hymns, and I'm using quotes around that say this is a song, this is a hymn. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, hymnos, the word that Paul uses in Colossians 3 mm-hmm. and in Ephesians, that word actually is more like what we would call a praise song. Than right. what we call hymns is not really right. what hymnos was. It was more of the praise song kind of thing, the testimonial kind of song. But so there's no musical designation of hymns. There's a cultural definition of hymns, and we typically define it as more theological, more information, a revelation and response. That's what we typically call hymns. Well, today's modern writers mm-hmm. are writing those again. And the reason they are is because pastors like you two said, you know what, I want our congregation to sing about God, not just sing about themselves.
Right, right. And how they feel.
And yeah. how they feel about God. I want our congregation to sing about God. And today's emerging writers, like a Matt Boswell is a great example, are writing songs that are more theologically embedded.
When you have some.
And that's a great thing.
You have some. I noticed this several years ago, maybe a decade ago. Or so, you know, groups like Cademan's Call, Indelible
sure.
Grace, so many,
sure.
they were kind of repackaging old hymns. Then you go to a conference and you see all these millennials singing this song like it was the greatest thing. And I'm like, y'all don't even know you sang
You don't even
hymn.
Know what you just sang. And you know what?
That's right.
That is still very much a trend in Christian music. There mm-hmm. are tons of artists that are redoing hymns, that are maybe writing new music to them, which was, by the way, I would tell anybody out there, don't ever fear that a hymn writer would be offended by what we're doing to their hymns. Mm. They would be thrilled we're using them. They
yeah.
really would. I could yeah. tell you how songwriters think. A hymn writer would be, thank, you know, they like Ode to Joy, he would be thrilled to know that we still sing it.
Right.
And so that, you know, we're not offending yesterday's hymn writers when we use their songs and refresh them and make them
yeah.
even in a current music style. And that is happening over and over. We just did a record. Lifeway Worship just produced a new record with Point of Grace.
Oh,
that
yeah?
is
really?
That is hymns and songs.
Wow, good. I know
and,
that.
And it's great. I mean,
does Heather Payne still sing with them? Does she sing
does
with
not.
Y'all?
Okay. She does not. Okay. There are three in the group now, Denise and Lee and Shelley.
Okay. The reason yeah. I asked that is I went to seminary with Brian, her
did
husband.
You? Did you?
We were
yeah.
in a doctoral program together.
Really?
So yeah.
yeah.
See,
yeah.
I was a huge, when I was a teenager, huge fan of Truth.
Yes.
Roger Brilliant's Truth
sure.
and Lee sang
Lee was in the
Truth.
Group. That's yeah. exactly
yeah.
right.
So I, that's
yeah.
how I
oh, yeah,
made
yeah.
that connection
yeah.
too.
Yeah.
Let me just say something. I'm really encouraged too that we were talking about this in the car the other day too, where we've gotten to the point where with a lot of these songs that are contemporary worship songs today, I'm encouraged that we're nitpicking a phrase or two.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Rather than throwing out the whole thing. Because
really?
There are a lot of songs that are good theologically, but may have something in there that we would question, a little phrase that we would say, I don't
yep.
like that. I don't like the wording of that phrase.
Can I give an example
so
of that?
So nitpicking that rather than throwing out the whole song.
Before you give the example, and I'm not going to spoil it,
yeah.
I'm very interested to see, because there is a song with a phrase right now that keeps my phone ringing.
I bet it does.
And so we're going to see it.
Let me see if this is it.
This will be it.
Because this was what provoked our,
yeah.
you know, what
yeah.
Matt was just talking about. You didn't want heaven
exactly.
without us. So you brought
exactly.
heaven down
knew that
to
was
us.
Coming.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
yeah.
Yeah, that is.
And there have been some people who have try to rephrase that when they sing it because they might not
We were just debating among ourselves, is it appropriate for us to tinker with the song like that if you wanted to change? I don't know.
Yeah, so this has got to ask. All right, yeah, so you have to answer the question. Can we do
is
that?
This, is this being recorded, by the way? All right, technically, no.
You cannot.
You are breaking the law when you change the lyrics.
Thanks for telling us, because we didn't know that.
Technically, you do not have the right to do that.
Good.
You are infringing. By the way, I would say this. This is the legal application. You're infringing on the rights of the copyright holder and the songwriter.
That's fair enough.
When you do that.
Right.
Yep. Now, most songwriters I know would be very understanding. Nobody's going to sue your church. But if you're wondering, is it legal or not? It's not legal.
Good. Okay, that clarifies that.
So there's a famous case of a hymnal that was done in recent years that took a phrase out of In Christ Alone and changed it.
Oh, really?
And did it without permission and put it in a hymnal. There was the wrath of God was satisfied.
Right. Yes.
Offended one particular group that was doing a hymnal. They didn't want to portray God's wrath as, you know, so the love of God was, I don't remember what they changed it to.
Magnified.
I think that was it. Mm-hmm. The love of God was magnified. That's exactly right. And I happened to be with Keith Getty around the time he heard about that change.
Wow.
And let's just say that there was some discussion around that.
Yeah.
And it wasn't that he got mad about it, but and in that case, the entire theology of that particular phrase was completely changed.
That's
so it wasn't a subtle change. It was a pretty dramatic change. All right, in the case of What a Beautiful Name, that's the song.
Awesome song. Tremendous song.
It's a great song.
Wow.
So this phrase has been problematic. You wouldn't want heaven without us. All right, so I happen to know the songwriter.
Okay.
And I've actually talked to her about this. Mm. It's from Hillsong. Mm-hmm. And by the way, I'm a huge fan of these people. Mm-hmm. I've gotten to know these people personally. We don't line up 100% doctrinally with their church. These people love God. I'm convinced of it. They're after the heart of God and what they're trying to do.
Putting out good
music. And they're putting out incredible songs. And by the way, that song is an amazing song. Phenomenal. It's so expressive, so worshipful. Mm-hmm. And it is also, by the way, chunked full of great theology.
It is.
That phrase is problematic. And I can tell you, the ones that have issues with it are thinking more about it and making it say something that the writers were not trying to say. They were not trying to say that heaven was incomplete.
Mm-hmm.
They're not trying to say that. They're expressing it. It is kind of human. They're giving a human emotion to Jesus there.
Yeah.
I've heard versions of it. I was somewhere, I'm not going to call them out because they did this without permission, but I was somewhere recently that was singing the song, and they sang instead, "You could have had heaven without us," and that's true. That and if they'd have written it that way, we'd still love the song. You didn't want heaven without us. As a matter of fact, Travis Cottrell, somebody I love and respect greatly, and does a lot of stuff for Lifeway. He and I had a long conversation. He called me one day, and this was like a year ago. He had just heard the song. He said, "I don't know what to do with this phrase. It's bothering me, but I'm not sure it should bother me." And he and I talked it through, and I said, "Well, it sort of bothers me," and we kind of worked it through. And both of us, I'll tell you where I landed. I will sing it the way they wrote it now. Because I came to the place of understanding that in the simplest way you understand that phrase, it is true. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. He could have had heaven. I mean, apparently he didn't want heaven with us because he did come down. But it certainly, I don't think the songwriter is trying to say heaven was somehow diminished because we weren't there.
I mean, I get
like
near
that.
Pentecostal when I hear you have no rival. You have no equal.
Absolutely.
Just coming out of it.
I love it.
So you know what I would encourage a church leader to do? If that song was part of your church's repertoire and it was an important song to you and that phrase was problematic, if I was a pastor of a church or preaching at a church, I'd talk about it. I'd say, look at this phrase and let's see what it says and what it doesn't
say. I heard
say.
Matt Bosel speak on that, and that phrase came up in a sort of a breakout session of a conference that we were at. And I really appreciate what Matt said. Matt said something like, This is the job of those who are leading.
Absolutely.
To teach. Use that as an opportunity to teach. If you don't like it, then say why you don't like it. But if you're going to sing it, say why you. If you know it's problematic, just try to use it as an opportunity to teach.
And here's what I would say. This is the principle I draw out of this whole conversation. You really can't parse lyrics the way you do scripture.
Yeah.
That you can't. The songwriters, when they're writing, they're not trying to cover every theological nuance in their phraseology. Anything that's on its face not true, sure, reject it.
Right.
But that in this case, that's a phrase that could be taken a bunch of different ways. You don't have to assume it in its worst form.
That's fair enough.
And that's further than the writer would go, than the writer's intending. And I would say, I would certainly, as a leader, I'd call it out with my people. I'd say, hey, let's talk about this phrase before we sing it. The same way I would, here I raise my Ebenezer. I would try to explain what I mean by that. You know, you want your people to understand what they're singing, but
right.
But I don't think it's always fair to parse lyrics the way, because scripture can stand up to that. Mm-hmm. Lyrics, they can't.
Yeah.
You know, they can't stand that kind of scrutiny. Mm.
Let me ask a question. This is sort of going off what we talked about a little bit earlier with hymnody and sort of older generation, younger generation. Mm-hmm. Let me talk to you. I want your take on multi-generational worship. With mm-hmm. the model that we've adopted for a long period of time is we end up needing or wanting two different services. You know, at so-and-so church, XYZ church is going to have a morning service, but now we're going to divide it up into two. We're going to have an early service, a late service, and now we have contemporary service and a traditional service. I'm not really worried about all that. That's not my question. My question is, how much should we or should we advocate for multi-generational worship? It kind of is difficult to do with that model. With separating contemporary and traditional service, you automatically are going to divide up for the most
part.
Well,
I love this subject, and I get this question because of Dr. Rainer. You guys may or may not know, but Dr. Rainer's podcast, which is listened to everybody, I think, that does anything in church, he has invited me into his world, and I'm on that podcast quite often. Mm-hmm. And my presence on Dr. Rainer's podcast has opened this conversation up with pastors all over the country.
That's great.
And I have this conversation all the time. I talk to more pastors than I do worship leaders, as a matter of fact, because I get this question a lot, and I always tell people this. 10 years ago, pastors would call me and say, hey, we're thinking about going to two different worship styles. What do you think? And I would talk about that. I won't tell you what I said, but I'd talk about that. That's not the phone call I get. I never get that call. Today I get the call. We've been in two worship styles for 15 years, and we're trying to put it back together.
Wow.
How do we do that?
Interesting.
Fascinating.
I would tell anyone out there, I don't have a research project that or data to point to, but there is no question churches are trending away from multiple worship styles and are trying to find an intergenerational experience that defines their church. And here's I'm gonna give some supposition why I think that's true. Churches have discovered after 15 years or so or 10 years or so of multiple worship styles that they really did create two congregations. And then the discipleship choices you make also impact this.
Right.
Most student pastors I know, I was a student pastor early in my ministry, always loved working with teenagers, but most student pastors want all of their youth in one service. So if you make those two choices, if you say this service is contemporary, that service is traditional, and all of our students are going to be in this one,
right,
you have just divided your church generationally in a way that I don't think any pastor would intentionally do. Mm. But over time, your church will become increasingly segregated generationally. Mm-hmm. Add to that the choice that many churches make of children's church.
Right.
And there are some scenarios where you could actually be a member of a church and not worship intergenerationally until you're 50 years old.
Well,
I mean, it could literally happen. Yeah.
Dr. Moeller did a podcast on that recently, he preached a sermon on this about we relegate our children to the nursery so much.
We
that,
do.
That you, well, here, might not here, worship with us.
I have real strong convictions about this. How long is this podcast?
As long as you got.
Because I've got a lot of stuff about this, and I get really jazzed up about this subject. I think intergenerational, and that is a trend, by the way, that churches are beginning to see, and I could point you to some resources along those, some great places to look at and think about. I think it's one of the greatest things that's happening right now in worship in churches, is churches are realizing that there's nothing quite as strong as the generations interacting with each other. Mm. As a matter of fact, I'm going to go further. I'm going to step outside my lane just a little bit. We've done the same thing. I'm about to preach. Are y'all ready for this?
I'm ready, man. Lay it on us.
We've done the same thing in our discipleship strategy, too. Mm. We've decided years ago that Bible study should be organized by life stage. Mm. I am a huge proponent of not doing it that way. And the reason I do this, I see churches, I see young adult classes sit around and talk about what they don't know about child rearing. They share, it's a common ignorance,
right,
when you have a homogenous approach generationally, even in your discipleship. I believe Titus chapter 2. I believe that the older should instruct the younger, that the older men do this, the younger women do that. And there's a ministry at the church I attend that has inspired me to believe this even more. It's called Apples of Gold. Mm. My wife teaches in this ministry, and that's why I'm so, and I actually teach in it. I'm the I'm the designated sniper that comes in and gets the husbands.
I love it.
But Apples of Gold is a ministry to young married women, taught by older married women.
I love it.
And it's about an 8-week study where they talk about hospitality. They talk about loving your husband well, loving your children well, work. I mean, all
the Titus
II
kind of model.
The Titus II model.
Yeah.
And they bring me in for the end of every semester, and I with the husbands, and I teach the husbands and talk about it. And watching these older women instruct these younger women, and watching the relational dynamic, and how it feeds both generations. The older women are alive in this conversation.
Yeah.
It brings meaning and purpose and redemption to their experiences. And then the younger women benefit in ways, I mean, I can't even describe. And we live in an era when coaching is a really big thing. Young men are being coached by older men.
That's right.
And this is happening in the corporate world every day,
right,
this executive coaching
right
thing. The church has got to figure this out, where the older and the younger, and if we isolate them worship-wise from each other and in their discipleship strategy, if churches isolate the generations from each other, mm-hmm, we miss the dynamic of the generations engaging. And this whole idea of intergenerational worship, where it's not about a music style.
Mm-hmm.
When you construct your worship experiences around a stylistic approach and inadvertently segregate the congregations from, I mean, the generations from each other, you actually, it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. The thing that you're saying you don't want to have happen is the very thing you're causing to happen by the choices you make just in those two kind of things. And then it deteriorates from there. Mm-hmm. So here's what I would say to any pastor out there. There is no worship style worth that. There isn't.
I agree.
And let me give you a couple more. I'm going to start throwing cliches out. All right, here comes the cliche part. These are all the bumper stickers.
This is tweetable stuff, so get ready.
Okay, here we go.
You can't lead in worship who you wish was there.
Mm-hmm.
You can't. And a music style cannot be a growth strategy. You can't say, well, we're going to go contemporary because we want to attract more millennials.
That's right.
It doesn't work. No. And let me tell you why.
The build it and they will come model.
It doesn't work in worship. Right. And let me tell you why. There is a value that millennials have actually over their preferences, and it is authenticity.
Right.
And a millennial will see through your veiled attempt to convince them to come to your church in the first song. They'll watch you worship, and they'll say, that's not them. This isn't who they are, because you won't do it well. That's not who you
that's
are.
Right.
And so I tell you what millennials are drawn to. They're drawn to authenticity in relationships. And if in a church where people were engaging and friendly and generations are interchanging, millennials want to be part of that. They didn't grow up in an intergenerational experience. Most of them came up through broken homes.
That's
many
true
of them did. And relational struggle is a big part of their life. A church that nails the intergenerational dynamic relationally could do a kazoo choir for music, and a millennial would be attracted to it. A millennial would be attracted to it because it'd be real, and it'd be engaging with people and relationally dynamic. And I would tell any pastor, don't think there's a worship style that's going to attract a generation to your church. It doesn't work. Mm-hmm. What you need is a relational authenticity that is true about the DNA of your church. Mm-hmm. That's what attracts young adults.
You know, our kids and youth are really connecting with our worship pastor and his vision for intergenerational worship ministry. One of the things that Greg has done since I've been there is he said, look, let's see if we can get our youth to do a youth choir. Everybody's saying, we don't do youth choirs anymore. Not going to happen. Let me tell you something.
Yeah.
Has revolutionized.
Absolutely.
Worship. And now what Greg is doing is now that he's
putting
got them
together
engaged, so they're up in the adult
love
choir
it
Sunday morning singing. I mean, it's just been beautiful.
If I could do it over, I never did that. I did it on special occasions. I would, 2 or 3 times a year, I'd do like one choir thing where all the children, all the students,
right,
I'd have 800 people. I got that idea from Bellevue Baptist. Jim Whitmire did that years ago. And I thought, well, Jim Whitmire's doing it all. That's right. But more and more churches, I'll give you, do you know Jay Strother? Do you happen to know Jay?
I don't.
He's at a church in Thompson Station, Tennessee, south of Franklin, south of Franklin in Nashville. It's called the Church at Station Hill. And they model this so well. As a matter of fact, their discipleship strategy is like this too. I don't know a church that's gone after the intergenerational dynamic more than this church has. And Cliff Duren is the worship pastor there.
Oh, I know Cliff.
He's the worship pastor there. If you go to their church, in the choir loft is grandma and grandson and moms and dads and children. It's 50 people of every generation. On the vocal team is a teenager next to.
That's awesome.
In the rhythm section, there's a guy playing guitar and a teenager sitting next to him. And I'm telling you, it's the most authentic thing to see it. And if I could do it over, if I was back in a church, I'd do it that way. Mm. I would. The generations would lead worship together. And and here's the great thing. This is good news for somebody out there. Stylistically, the difference between traditional and contemporary is getting smaller and smaller and smaller. It really is over time. And now the ability to find something that, and I hate the word blended. Blended is only good in a milkshake. It's not good in worship. If you're blended in the senses, we're going to do one hymn, one worship song, and one. That's not blended. That's a mess. Is what that is. But finding an approach that encompasses all of it, which you can do, it's easier than it's ever done. As a matter of fact, LifewayWorship.com is a website that we provide congregational resources at. Let me say that again. It's called LifewayWorship.com.
Good, thanks.
Thank you. And it's hymns and songs and all everything in between, done in ways that can be done stylistically in a lot of ways. But a church finds their way of doing it, their way where they win with it and execute it well in a way that every generation can resonate with us. And I'll tell you something I learned years ago when I used to be at Cross Gates Baptist in Brandon, Mississippi, a great church. I was there almost 7 years. I remember one Sunday I was leading a song that wasn't a hymn, and I saw an older gentleman that I respected greatly, a great leader in the church. I saw him emotionally engaged. He was actually crying while I was singing the song. But he wasn't singing it. And I thought, I'm going to ask him about that. It looked like he wasn't singing, but he was affected. And so I asked him about it the next day. He came in the office and I said, hey, I noticed in this song that you were emotional, but you weren't singing it. And here's what he told me. I've never forgotten it. And this may help somebody out there. He said, well, you know, I hate that song. and then he says, matter of fact, I hate a lot of the music that we do in our church. I don't really like most of the songs you're doing. And I said, well, okay. And we were good friends, and he was being sort of funny, but he was also serious, and I knew he was. He said, but the reason I was emotional is I was looking across that sanctuary, and I was watching you lead, and he said, I could see God at work in those families, and I could see people engaged. He said, and I was just praying, thank you, God, for what you're doing in our church and how you're using Mike. And he said, I hate the song, but I love what God's doing. Now, here's the point I want to make. Your senior adults will get behind what God's doing.
Yeah, they will.
They will.
They sure will.
And if you can lead your music ministry in a way that connects the spiritual dots, and it's not about we're going contemporary, we're going traditional, we're trying to do something blended, we're trying to make everybody happy. It's not that at all. If the language becomes, we are after the heart of God, we're after people singing about God and responding to Him in worship and song, we're about discipling our kids with great theology, we're about all. If you can make the points and the objectives spiritual and communicate that well to your senior adults or to your young adults, people that are walking with God will rally around the spirit of it.
That's cool.
And you won't have the worship war anymore but to do that, you've got to have more than a musician.
That's right.
You got to have a shepherd.
That's right.
Yes. Who's leading it.
Yeah.
But I used to run to those senior adults, and man, I remember telling a guy in my church one time had a problem with the music we were doing, and I said, hey, if you can't believe in what I'm doing, can you believe in what I'm trying to do?
That's good.
And if you'll give me 30 minutes of your time and let me buy you a cup of coffee, I'm going to tell you tomorrow what I'm trying to do.
Yeah.
And I met with that guy for 30 minutes and began to pour out my heart about what God had called me to do and what I was trying and why I did what I did. He became my biggest supporter.
Wow.
So if you'll communicate the why and give a spiritual objective and purpose to what you're doing, you can do any music style.
That's
cool. If you put it in that term.
That's good.
Matt, I could talk all day.
I could too,
to Mike Harlan.
This is
could
awesome.
You not?
Man, this is awesome.
I want to say that website again, lifewayworship.com. Mike, you also have a podcast you do as well, correct?
I have a podcast and blog site.
Okay.
That's worshiplife.com.
Okay, worshiplife.com.
And all of our blogs, I blog on this stuff all the time, and our podcast, our podcast is once a week, comes out on Tuesday. You can subscribe to it, and a lot of people do. And we talk about this sort of thing. Now, every once in a while, we'll get real musical and technical about mm-hmm. music stuff. And I give any pastor out there, if I get into something that doesn't interest you, turn the thing off. But almost every conversation is just like the one we're having here today about leading worship in a church. Because here's what I believe. In music, God gave us one of the most dynamic discipleship tools we could ever have in our hands. Parents know that the power of melody. We teach our children the alphabet with it. Mm-hmm. We've seen all the studies point to, and when you sing something, not just hear something, when you sing something, it goes into the part of your personal experience that even disease doesn't touch. I mean, people with Alzheimer's who cannot tell you their name sing every word of a song.
Yes, yes.
And I've actually researched that enough, and there's some medical reasons why that's true. The activity of singing, when you marry information with melody, something happens in the human brain that we don't have any other tool that does it. I hate to tell you pastors this, but nobody's quoting your sermons on their deathbed.
That's a fact.
They're not.
You're right about
but
that.
But they are singing, "My Jesus, I love
you." That's exactly
you.
Yep. Right. Yep.
And so does that not make what we're doing as worship leaders even more significant? Good. I mean, we've got to use this tool to disciple people, to help them put the truth of God in a place in their soul that will take them into the darkest hours of their
life.
I mean, that's what our job is.
You know, I don't know about you, Matt, but and my folks make fun of me sometimes for this, but Mike, I will actually sing.
Yes.
In my sermons, before my sermon, after my sermon, and invite people into that. It's awkward a little bit at the start, especially if I don't start off on the right key. But
at least you're trying.
They may not remember a whole lot of the sermon, but they will remember something moves us to song.
Oh, yeah.
And gets us singing. I mean, you look out there, people are crying.
Yeah.
And I'm like,
they weren't
crying.
Well, they may be crying for a different reason, but that's enough. But
we assume that. Yeah.
But watch this. Can I help you? Yeah. And you guys have studied this. There are six different passages in the New Testament of Paul's writing, where he wrote in song form.
Right.
Romans 11, 33 through 36.
That's
that
right.
Goes right into Romans 12. Mm-hmm. Colossians 1, 15 through 20.
Huge
Christology. He's the image of the invisible God,
that's
the firstborn
right.
over all
that's
creation.
Right.
Mm. One of the most important Christological passages in all the New Testament is in song form. Philippians 2, let this mind be in you, which is Christ, is in song form. 1 Corinthians 13, if I speak with the tongue of men and angels, it's in song form. What Paul do in prison, he sang. I mean, Paul understood the power of song.
Mm.
Moses understood it. Moses, there's several songs. Matter of fact, Revelation 15 says that we will sing the song of the Lamb and the song of Moses. We're gonna sing one of Moses' songs in heaven. And I, as a songwriter, I'm like, but you think I'll get one on the playlist? I don't know.
You might.
But David understood the power of song.
That's
he
right.
wrote 72 Psalms that we know of. I bet he wrote thousands that we'd never heard. I mean, there is a, and by the way, yesterday's great preachers knew this. Spurgeon was a songwriter.
That's right.
I know most people say his songs weren't very good, but Spurgeon was a songwriter. Isaac Watts, all the Wesley brothers, on and on. Which leads me to a question. I've never wondered why today's singers don't preach or songwriters don't preach, but I have wondered why today's preachers don't write songs.
Wow.
That's an interesting thing. Yesterday's preachers wrote songs. The great hymn writers were preachers.
That's a great challenge.
Interesting.
And that's an interesting thought. And I think the reason that's been true historically in the church is they understood the power of song. Mm. And I'm telling you, this weapon that God's put in our hands. Matter of fact, Psalm 149:6 says, "Let the word of praise be in your mouth and a two-edged sword in your hands." Mm. There's the picture of God's truth and God's worship in the mouth of God's people.
Mm.
And the role of that, the rest of the psalm says, to inflict justice on the nations. I mean, it becomes the weapon that we prosecute God's justice to the world is the worship that we sing when we sing God's truth and marry it to melody. So
wow, that's awesome.
Anyway, You're right. I could talk all day about this stuff.
That's cool. So. All right. I wish we had more time. Mike, you got to go. You got to get out of here. And we've probably talked too long. But but let me wrap up the podcast. We've got just a minute.
Okay.
With a segment that we normally call headlines. And there's a really important, I think a very critical headline that just came out this past week. And, Mike, I want to get your take on this. I'm just going to mention it. We found out this past week that in headlines all across the nation that the Pope now has made a statement about his theology of heaven and hell.
Mm-hmm.
And he has now basically said he does not believe in a hell, in an eternal place of torment. Hmm. Give us your take on that. Mike, you've heard about this.
Yeah,
what have you read?
It.
I've only read the headlines. I've not read the articles that are out there, so I don't know as much as
As a good Southern boy would say, he's crawfishing on it now. Okay, so he's trying to back out of it and this kind of thing. Vatican's trying to clean it up. But what's interesting is he was quoted by an atheist journalist over there, and they're claiming he misquoted him, all this kind of stuff. But what he's doing is he's advocating essentially a view called annihilationism, that when you die, your soul ceases to exist and you're just gone. But if you're saved or a Christian, then obviously you continue on to eternal life. It's a view out there. You know, incidentally enough, one of my heroes in the faith, John Stott, ended up with this view at the end of his life and ministry. So, but anyways, what he's doing is he's going against the creeds of the Catholic Church, all the teaching, the councils, and all the popes before him. So he's really
he's
a bad spot.
A little bit renegade from his past, yeah.
And so, you know, other people are going to talk about this. I think it's unfortunate because as Mohler on his briefing pointed out, and I think he's right, Jesus taught more about hell in the New Testament than he did heaven for a lot of different reasons. But, man, if you don't have a hell, Mike Harlan, and you don't have, I mean, what is the gospel good news for if we're not being rescued from sin, death,
that's
and
right.
the devil?
If you
that's
can't
right.
believe all of it, you can't believe any of it.
Yeah.
That's right.
I think when you start pulling out bricks from the theology of Scripture, it's all going to crumble, and it scares me for him.
It does, and
it also bothers me. I mean, I the Catholic Church. You meet a lot of different kinds of people that are Catholic, and I've met some. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, a great songwriter that I love and respect greatly is a Catholic. Mm-hmm. I asked him one time, "Why are you Catholic?" And because your songs don't seem to necessarily represent a Catholic point of view, he said, "I'm Catholic because it was a Catholic church that won me to Christ." He said, "If the Baptist had walked across the street and won me to Christ, I'd be a Baptist." That's when I stopped talking about it with him. But anyway,
enough said.
Yeah, but so there's I hate it for the struggle that this puts on some people that are of the Catholic tradition for whatever reason, and yet really do possess a high view of Scripture.
Yep.
I hate it for them.
Yeah, I do too. And I'm afraid theologically, I'm afraid he's trying to reflect what a lot of the culture
and
a lot of Catholics want to believe that there is no hell. They really, because in reality, on the inside of us, we don't want there to be a reality of hell.
Right.
Because if there is a reality of hell, then we're accountable and we have to deal with that. If there is no hell, we're released from that accountability. We don't have to deal with that. And so I think he's reflecting somewhat in his own theology what the culture and part of maybe even the church is wanting is a lack of responsibility.
And, you know, as Protestants who flow from the Reformation, who broke away from, what's fascinating to me is, so there was a Catholic priest running around by the name of Tetzel talking about selling indulgences for people's loved ones to get out of purgatory so that they wouldn't go to hell, they'd go to heaven. And, I mean, this is just this is a historic doctrine. It's a biblical doctrine, obviously. It's a horrible doctrine.
Yeah.
But let's be honest. It is there because the reality is, apart from the work of Christ, the person and work of Christ, we're lost and dead in our sins. Yeah. We're headed for a really horrible
place. The other lesson
place.
Of this for me, I've just finished that Luther biography that Metaxas wrote, and I recommend it to anybody that hadn't read it. There's a chapter in there about these prophets that comes from Svitgout. I don't know if I said that right or not, who came with heresies, including the indulgences and the images and all of those things that were happening. And they had almost a prosperity gospel that were coming out of the Catholic Church in Luther's era. And when I read that chapter, I thought, there really is nothing new under the sun.
I mean,
this whole thing about annihilism is, that's not new. Mm-hmm. It just keeps coming back.
That's right.
So, wow.
Anyway, well, let me close the podcast. For our listeners, you can check us out, gospelrain.com, find us, share us and all that kind of stuff out there on iTunes. But let me just say real quickly, you can find Mike on Worship Life. That's the name of the podcast. Mm-hmm. Is that right? You can just go to Worship Life.
Worshiplife.com. It's on iTunes.
Okay.
Or you can go to our website. They're all there. And we have podcasts and blogs, a lot of stuff there.
Good. A lot of helpful resources. We hope a lot of our listeners will check
it
out.
By the way, I want to invite your listeners to this. We have a Worship Life conference that's in Gatlinburg, and I have a pastor's track. A lot of pastors come with their worship leader. It's in the last week of June. And this year, organizing and teaching and training our pastor's track is Jim Shaddix, great preacher, professor from Southeast Seminary. He's a longtime friend of mine. He's going to be teaching a pastor's track at our worship conference in Gatlinburg, so I'd encourage people to check that out.
That's cool. Where do you go to find that out?
It's at worshiplife.com. Okay. You'll see everything. It's all there.
All right, cool. Well, let me close the podcast. Until next time, we'll see you again on Gospel Rain.
Thank you for joining us for the Gospel Rain podcast. We hope you've been encouraged today, and we pray the gospel will reign in your life this week. Make sure to follow us on Facebook and Twitter, or check out our website at gospelrain.com.